July 3, 1981 was when news of what would eventually be called the AIDS epidemic first surfaced formally in the mass media in a shocking story in the New York Times. It was an extremely hot day in Manhattan. I hated being stuck in the city during the summer. I had left the New York native office on West 57th Street late and picked up an early edition of the New York Times. When I got home, I was very tired but was shaking by the time I finished reading the story. It would be one of those moments when time stood still, like the Kennedy assassination or the moment decades later when I turned on the TV the morning of 9/11. At the time I was the publisher and editor-in-chief of New York Native, a gay paper that had been started the previous December. In the ensuing days and weeks, I struggled to get a hold of the emerging foggy facts about the mysterious new disease while grappling with the state of severe anxiety that the terrifying news had aroused in me. My fears were existential. Dark thoughts scurried like mice from the basement. Would my newspaper even survive the unknowns we now faced? Would I? As I began to calm down and accept the situation I was in, I soon chose a determined, pragmatic path for the newspaper. It was the time for the brave front. I would devote the paper to methodically getting to the bottom of the emerging epidemic and make the disease the newspaper's signature story. While I was personally terrified of the implications, as a publisher I sensed that this was going to be a huge event. There were opportunities here. I tried to be optimistic. For the next four decades I would always try to be optimistic. I told myself that in an age of scientific and technological genius and daily miracles, surely a cause would be found and a cure would follow. Wasn't that how science operated? Anyway, what was the alternative? In the ensuing days and weeks, I struggled to get a hold of the emerging amorphous facts about the mysterious new disease while grappling with the state of severe anxiety that the terrifying news had aroused in me and everyone I knew. What I would eventually learn is that epidemics never have a second chance to make a first impression.
Existential apocalypse came our way. Existential apocalypse ruled the day. It was raining death and it wouldn't stop. We were men in dark times, waiting for the next shoe to drop. May you never know the things that we went through, but if it happened to us, it could happen to you. We were men in dark times, may all your dark times make you strong and wise. May you never fall for a plate full of lies. We were men in dark times, cut down in our primes. We're men in dark times. We wondered if it would ever end. Who could we trust?
Existential apocalypse came our way. Existential apocalypse ruled the day.
It was raining death and it wouldn't stop. We were men in dark times, waiting for the next shoe to drop. May you never know.
Men in dark times, may your existential apocalypse make you strong and wise. May you never fall for a plane full of lies. We were men in dark times, cut down in our prime. We're men in dark times.
Wondering if it would ever end.
Who could we trust? Was a friend. We were men in dark times.
It was raining death and it wouldn't stop. We were men in dark times, men for the next shoe to drop.
May you never call the things that we went through, but if it happened to us, it could happen.
In that early period of the epidemic, scientists launched decades of mistakes when they noticed first that specific disease-fighting cells in the immune system, namely T cells, were not functioning or were decimated in gay men. The technology that identified T cells had only recently been discovered. This would turn out to be analogous to the joke about the drunk looking for his keys under the only light in a parking lot. It would turn out to be malware. AIDS would turn out to be so much more than a T-cell problem. Many terrified gay men started going to their doctors to find out whether anything was wrong with their T-cells, and to my chagrin, at the time it seemed like everyone I talked to, who had a T-cell test, found out that they were suffering from a T-cell deficiency. Now wondering what was going on in the immune system of only gay men would be more malware within the malware. It was hard at the time not to wonder apocalyptically if gay men were all were going to get this disease and die. In the early days of any horrifying epidemic, it seems like anything is possible. Unfortunately, it was mostly gay American men who were running to their doctors. If the whole country had followed suit, history might have turned out differently. That antivirus program would come later. Recognition of the connection to chronic fatigue syndrome might have been the perfect antiviral for the malware back then, but it was not meant to be. In the early days of the epidemic, everything about AIDS was gay, gay, gay. You could see what was happening in the vicious jokes that were circulating. Why is common sense like AIDS? Some are born with it while others have to get it pounded into them. How do you turn a fruit into a vegetable? AIDS. What's meaner than a pit bull with AIDS? The guy that gave it to him. From 1981 to early 1983, every kind of scientific hypothesis in the world was discussed as the possible cause of AIDS. Everyone was a theoretician. As a publisher eager to know every possibility and to share them with the readers of New York Native, I was willing to listen to anyone who had an idea. I felt that the right answer could come from anywhere. Some people thought that AIDS was caused by recreational drug use. Every fact, real or suspected, about gay people would feed the beast of malware. If someone had come to me in the early days and said, "Did you know that heterosexuals all over the country are going to their doctors with mysterious immunological problems and they are calling it chronic fatigue syndrome?" I would have connected the dots immediately. Epidemics never have a second chance to make a first impression. One thing that never went away was the false idea that AIDS was a sexually transmitted disease, and the gay community fell for it hook, line, and sinker. People always looked at the epidemic through gay STD glasses. That was the malware at the very center of an epidemic of scarlet letter lies.
Welcome to the age of not knowing what is really true. No one knows where to turn or what to do. Welcome to the age of finger pointing and blame and every kind of shame. Welcome to the scarlet letter game. There's so much fear, nothing is clear, and nothing is ever gonna be the same when you're trapped in a scarlet letter game. You experts rule the day.
we've got, so we all depend on your integrity, even if we should not.
You say if we don't listen, none of us survives. You're in charge, we're trusting you with our lives.
We don't know where to turn in this age of blame and shame.
Trapped in the scarlet letter game.
We're all trapped in the scarlet letter game.
Even when it's totally absurd, we have to believe your every word. We don't want to die.
When you say jump, we ask how.
Alarmingly, the cases began to mount. In the New York Native, the paper thoroughly covered each disturbing development that basically kept gay men in a permanent state of existential dread, always waiting for the next horrifying headline about the epidemic. As New York Native's reporting on the epidemic took up more and more space in New York Native, the circulation started to go down. Many people in the New York gay community wanted me to downplay the epidemic because they felt it was bad for the image of gay people and disastrous for gay businesses. One prominent businessman who spent a great deal of money advertising in the Native told me he was considering leaving the paper if we continued to cover the epidemic. He was concerned about the community's business, and the Native's, but I felt it was the paper's responsibility to cover the story and to get to the bottom of it. To borrow a notion from Hannah Arendt, I felt like world history had broken out and New York Native was destined to play a part in the thick of it. I even fantasized that New York Native might play a significant role in ending the epidemic. I had no idea that the monster we were about to cover and confront was not only scientific, but also political. Very political. Who knew? At one business meeting early in the epidemic, two of my advertising salespeople, Derek and Daniel, implored me to cut down on the coverage of the epidemic or at least keep it off the cover of New York Native. I told them that was not possible and that they would both have to try harder to sell ads. Within 4 years they were both dead from AIDS. A friend of mine who was also a close friend of Derek and Daniel's described their agonizing deaths as crucifixions. If you are someone who believes what you read on Wikipedia, you will notice that history has generally been kind to the first few years when New York Native diligently covered the establishment's science of AIDS and kept track of the crucifixions. In Rolling Stone, David Black said New York Native deserved a Pulitzer Prize for our early coverage of AIDS. In his bestseller, And the Band Played On, Randy Schiltz wrote, "The major gay newspaper in New York. The New York Native was crowded with stories about the new diseases, with detailed writing by a physician." In those days people started to say the name of the newspaper should have been the New York Native Journal of Medicine. Every day, I went to the office in a sense of dread about what we would be reporting on.
Did you see what's in the New York Native today? Oh God, oh why? You won't believe what they're reporting now. Did you see what's in the New York Native today?
news is always grim, and there are rumors at the gym that it will get worse. If it's really sad or really bad, you know you'll read it in the native first.
Did you see what's in the New York Native today? Why do they have to scare us? Why can't they spare us the gory details? Why can't they just make some good news when all else fails? Did you see what's in the New York Native today?
We buy it every Monday, and then we hold our breath as we read the latest news that frightens us to death.
On March 14, 1983, I created a Frankenstein. I published what would turn out to be the most talked about piece and most consequential in the New York Native's history. At 5,000 words, it was also the longest. 1,112 and counting, by screenwriter and novelist Larry Kramer, appeared prominently on the cover, and many now consider it the alarm that launched, for better or worse, the era of AIDS activism. It rocked New York City, and it is still celebrated in the bamboozled world of AIDS activism and by historians who don't have a clue about the real nature of the AIDS epidemic. I had met Kramer when my publication, Christopher Street, featured him and Andrew Holleran in the mid-70s when their novels came out. I had been smitten by the unexpected brilliance of Holleran's Dancer from the Dance. As for Kramer, when I saw the title of Kramer's novel, Faggots, it was distrust at first sight. It was an omen of things to come. I spent a night with Holleran and Kramer at a disco and, looking back, I had a feeling that our ambivalence was mutual, but in the early years of the epidemic, when Kramer handed me the piece at a lunch he had requested, I could see that it was the right piece at the right time for New York Native. I didn't realize Kramer would turn out to be one of the most dangerous windbags in history. Decades after the publication of the AIDS activism launching piece, I am struck by the way it did capture at least the terror and the panic and the sense of impending catastrophe and doom in the gay community. Kramer got that right, but panic and fear are grist for the mill of political and scientific malware. Malware could see the gay community the way a mouse sees cheese. My first instincts were democratic because I didn't have a clue that science was about to become as totalitarian as Stalin's Russia. I followed some imaginary rulebook for publishers. I committed myself to making the pages of The Native available to any writer who would make a credible attempt to explain politically or scientifically what was going on or offer ideas on how to deal with the disaster that seemed to be growing exponentially on a daily basis. My assumption was that everyone was acting in good faith. The premise itself was malware. Kramer began the iconic article, "If this doesn't scare the shit out of you, we're in real trouble. If this article doesn't rouse you to anger, fury, rage and action, gay men may have no future on earth. Our continued existence depends on just how angry you can get." A kind of proud-as-punch activist performance road rage would become the fuel of malware that would infect the entire gay community. Signals were sent to the non-gay community that they were supposed to be in awe of the flamboyant political demonstrations they held. The forced celebration of anger became a kind of gaslighting of anyone who wasn't calm and thoughtful enough to see what was really happening. One person with chronic fatigue syndrome told him years after the publication of the Kramer piece that she approached Kramer after one of his public jeremiads and said, "Mr. Kramer, I just want to thank you for your anger." Over the years, urging people to be angry began to strike me as a very peculiar gospel. The blind celebration of anger would lead to decades of mindless exploitable pseudo-activism. AIDS activism would be zombie anger 24/7. It would be the malware that turned the gay community into a self-defeating misdirected mob. Throughout his piece, Kramer portrayed the gay community as being on the brink of extinction. He presented the current numbers of dead and dying and left the impression of a tsunami of a plague that might engulf every single gay man in its path. He wrote, "For the first time in the epidemic, leading doctors and researchers are finally admitting they don't know what is going on." His parade of horribles included a doctor who was sorry he ever got involved with the mysterious disease, packed hospitals, patients being treated as lepers, and gay suicides in the face of the horror. He decried the outrageous lack of funding for research, blaming it on anti-gay prejudice. He wrote that the straight medical community, which supposedly knew the disease was not going to stay limited to gays, could, quote, "use us as guinea pigs to discover the cure for AIDS before it hits them, which most medical authorities are still convinced will be happening shortly in increasing numbers." And use us, they ultimately did. What Kramer didn't know, and ultimately would not want to know, was that under the guise of oh-so-mysterious chronic fatigue syndrome, AIDS was already enjoying an immunological all-you-eat buffet in the so-called straight community. Let us stop for a moment and meditate on the notion of guinea pigs begging to be guinea pigs. Kramer's wish became the government's command. Kramer took a demonizing shot at the man who would become his personal bete noir, New York City's Mayor Ed Koch. He wrote, "Repeated attempts to meet with him have been denied us. Repeated attempts to have him make a very necessary public announcement about this crisis and public health emergency have been refused by his staff." He complained about the mayor's liaison to the gay community, Herb Rickman, basically portraying him as a gay enemy of the gay community, someone who was incompetent and insensitive to the political needs of the hour. For Kramer, public pronouncements were everything. It was as though publicity would be the cure for the plague. Kramer was celebrity obsessed, so it figures. It was the reclaiming of the McCarthy tactic of naming names. As though shaming a closeted gay person was a political act of liberation. Heterosexuals could watch outing from the sidelines snickering with delicious glee. Let them do the exposure themselves. We don't have to lift a finger.
March my darlings, don't hide under your bed and cry. And if you don't listen to me, you all certainly will die. When the darkness fell across our land, I saw the opportunity to set my ego free for fame and prosperity and just be me, totally, obnoxiously me. March, march, my darlings, look sharp and stay in line. You'll all be so busy, you won't have time to notice that I've lost my ever-loving mind. March, my darlings. Never ever waste a play when you can take center stage and make some think you are divine. Never able to see the possibility that I've lost my ever-loving mind. March, my darlings, march, my darlings. When everyone's on the move and everyone is afraid, with terror in their eyes, no one will realize